We're in Acts chapter 27, which is a good thing, because we've got two chapters to go, and we've only got 3 days, so all I have to do is average a chapter and a half a day, which may prove difficult. Where are we? Where have we been? I'm not talking about the test. I'm not talking about the blackout on Friday. I'm talking about in the text. Where are we, or where have we been? Caesarea. Why have we been in Caesarea? What? He's on trial. Before whom? Felix first, then Festus, then Agrippa. Exactly. We have three different trials all in the same place. So how long has Paul been hanging out in good old Caesarea? At least 2 years, right? 2 years between Felix and Festus. But it's possibly a little bit over that, depending on how long. It's probably about, 2 years in a month or so. He's been hanging out there every time he's been found innocent. But what has Paul done in order to really, in a sense, preserve himself within his innocence? Appealed to Caesar. Paul is on his way to Rome. Chapter 27, we're going to spend, and the beginning of 28, we're just going to begin trying to get to Rome. Because getting to Rome is going to prove quite difficult. We'll go ahead and just pick it up in 27 verse 1. Before we get there, there's a couple of things about chapter 27 that I need to kind of read and talk about how the way in which it's been interacted with throughout history. Chapter 27, it is tempting to find chapter 27 as somewhat boring. Tempting. The reason why is because it's just like, ho-hum, there's a shipwreck. There, summarize chapter 27, moving on to 28. No, there's actually a lot of really intriguing things happening in 27. As a matter of fact, Thomas Walker says this about chapter 27. He says, there is no such detailed record of the working of an ancient ship in the whole of classical literature. As a historian, that excites me. Because literally, this is a treasure trove of information of how ships even worked. As a matter of fact, a guy by the name of James Smith in 1848, he was a yachtsman from Scotland, amateur geologist, was a soldier by profession. He was writing a book on this chapter alone. So what he does is he goes and he lives in the area of Malta and Lisbon and Malta. Gibraltar was the other one. The years leading up to writing this book. So he's studying the weather patterns and studying the land and figuring out how the way in which the wind would come off. And his analysis of chapter 27 was this. He says, chapter 27, no sailor would have written in a style so little like that of a sailor. So chapter 27 was not written by a sailor. Why? Because the words he uses and the ways in which he describes it, you could tell no sailor would have written like that. He says, no man, not a sailor, could have written a narrative of a sea voyage so consistent in all its parts unless from actual observation. Matter of fact, he even goes on to say this is probably one of the most historically verifiable chapters in the entire Bible. Because it's just so accurate, even though you can tell a sailor wasn't writing it. Let's just compound the oddity of chapter 27 a bit more. A guy by the name of Sir William Ramsay in 1960 writes the book St. Paul the Traveler and Roman Citizen. Ramsay was a yachtsman. He was very well versed in the way in which traveling by sea worked. And he was a skeptic. He was not a Christian. And he actually goes to chapter 27 with his yacht and tries to prove the Bible wrong but just by tracing what is described here. And by the end of it, I'm not kidding, by the end of it, Sir William Ramsay was so convinced of the veracity of chapter 27, he converts because of chapter 27. So even though it may look like just some random sea voyage that ends in this ridiculous, whatever the word is, shipwreck, let's not minimize it throughout history because it's actually been paid attention to quite thoroughly. Chapter 27, verse 1. When it is decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners, let's stop right there. What did you notice? Hello, we's back, right? The we passages have picked back up. As a matter of fact, the very last time we saw the we passages was in chapter 21, verse 28, which would have been around the time what was happening to Paul. Close. He was in Jerusalem in 21. It's whenever he was arrested, right? So whenever he was arrested and ends up going on to trial after trial after trial after trial after trial. and the we passages dissipate because it was Paul that was imprisoned and they weren't with him. It's been over 2 years since the we passages have picked up. Now we're going to be entering into the longest we section throughout the entire book of Acts. Chapter 27, verse 1, all the way through chapter 28, verse 16. In verse 17, Paul will be imprisoned in Rome and the we passages will stop once again. So we set sail for Italy. So who's going with Paul at the least? Luke, at the least. Paul and some other prisoners. Who were the other prisoners? More than likely, they were not necessarily related to Christianity, but there were other people that just needed to be transported to. Maybe there are other Roman citizens that appealed before prison or before Caesar. They've appealed to Caesar, or maybe it's prisoners that were being taken to be used in the gladiatorial games inside of Rome. We don't know exactly who they were, but Paul isn't the only prisoner on the ship, or only prisoner traveling. I guess I should say, because he'll switch ships. At least once. And some other prisoners were handed over to the centurion named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. Good old Julius. There's a couple things you need to recognize about Julius. Number one, he is a centurion. And in the New Testament, it is unbelievable, but in the New Testament, almost across the board, centurions are painted in a positive light. They're the good guys, which is weird, isn't it? Why is that a bit strange? Yeah, because they're Roman army leaders. But man, when you look in Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, or which is the parallel passage of Luke 7, 1 through 10, it is the faith of a centurion that amazes Jesus. Jesus goes on and heals the servant of the centurion. And then in Matthew chapter 8, Jesus says, "I've not found faith like this in all of Israel." Talking about a centurion. Then you go to Matthew chapter 27, verse 54, which is parallel passage to Luke 23, 47, and you have the centurion crying out, "Surely this was the Son of God." A centurion at the foot of the cross saying, "Jesus is the King." Where else do we see centurions and they're painted in a positive light? What?
Cornelius.
Cornelius, Acts chapter 8. Cornelius is a centurion in Caesarea. And now we have Acts chapter 27, Julius. This guy is mentioned as a centurion, so what would, based on the rest of the New Testament evidence, what can we assume about this guy? He's probably a good guy too, right? That's what you find in verse 3, whenever Paul goes to Sidon, he lets Paul go and visit his friends. In verse 43, you actually even have this guy will save Paul's life whenever the rest of the soldiers want to kill him. Julius. What else do we know about him? Number one, he's probably being accompanied by some of, if not all of his men. He is a centurion. How many people would he be over? At least 100. Around 100. I shouldn't say at least. At most 100. Although that could fluctuate depending on the circumstances. We also know that he's a part of the imperial regiment. Actually, in the Greek, this would be a better translated, the Augustan cohort. Which would mean that this guy was possibly one of the soldiers that was in charge of being the personal bodyguard of the emperor himself. This guy's no joke. This is Julius. Yeah, it is Julius. And more than likely, his name also indicates that his family received their citizenship 60 to 90 years earlier under a guy by the name of Julius Caesar. Why? Because that's what his name indicates. This is a pretty important guy. Are you seeing what's being built here? Not only is he a centurion, he is probably one of the personal bodyguards of Nero himself, and he has a long-standing tradition of a family that's been citizens for quite a long time. Very well trusted, very well honored man. Therefore, when he steps onto any ship, he is in control. Does that make sense? You'll find out here in just a minute. It doesn't matter who owns the ship. It doesn't matter who's sailing the ship. If Julius is on board, he is in control. Why? Why? Say it again.
He's a sort of official in the government. I mean, he's high up in the army. He's over people. And he expects everyone to be underneath him when he's a government, or especially military official.
Yeah, exactly. And what you're describing is honor shame. In an honor-shame culture, the one that has the most honor, if he walks into the room, he's the one that calls the shots, and that's just the way it is. Doesn't matter if he owns the place. Doesn't matter. Monetary ownership does not indicate the one that's in charge in an honor-shame culture. It's the one that carries with them the economy that means the most, and that's honor. And Julius has a lot of it. Julius, a centurion of the imperial regiment. Verse 2, we boarded a ship from Adramidium about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia. And we put out to sea. Couple of things. Number one, Adramidium. Where is Adramidium? Let me zoom in on where Adramidium is. It's up there at the top. Do we see it? Everybody follow me? Right now, we're down here. We're down in Caesarea. They've gone from Jerusalem to Caesarea over a period of, you know, a little bit, whenever Claudius Lysias sent him over to Felix. Spends 2 years in Caesarea. They are going from Caesarea on a ship that is going to Adramidium. Why? Why would they do that? Because where are they ultimately trying to go? Rome, which is all the way over here. Oh, you can't see my finger. All the way over there. So why would they go from here to there if they really want to go from here to there? What would be some of the factors that would make them go to Adramidium? Say it again. Maybe it's a trade route. What else? That actually is accurate. We'll talk about that in a minute. Marquise? Yeah, that's a good one. Maybe it's just a nautical, logistical issue. Because if you're going to go from here to there, you're in the open sea. And you don't want to be in the open sea. As a matter of fact, the exact ship that they're boarding would have looked something along the lines of this. Small ship. Coastline ship. One that is intentionally made to go along the coast, not to go out into the open sea. During this time of year, during every point in the year, Caesarea does not really have a lot of direct trade routes to Rome. The geographical location is a deterrent, as well as their interaction is just much different. But Adramidium, on a ship like this, you could board a ship like this on Caesarea and go all the way up the coastline until you hit Adramidium. Now, the advantages of going up there is if you can't find another ship to get onto, it's so that you can maybe hop maybe at Cnidus here. You could find Cnidus, maybe you could find an Alexandrian ship that then you could take it the rest of the way over to here, a bigger ship that's made for more open seas. If you can't find that, once you hit Adramidium, you are just south. Here's where Adramidium would be. You're just south of the Via Ignatia, the big Roman road that stretches 530 miles across this region that takes you all the way over to the coast. And notice what's right here. It's Italy. You can take a short little ship over here and then make your way up to Rome. So he hops on an Adramidium ship like this that's bound for a city that's not the city of their ultimate destination. And the reason why he does that is because it gives him options, logistical options, safe logistical options to make it all the way to Rome eventually. Does that make sense? We're going to be piecing together this event like this because every detail is very important. Noting ultimately what ends up happening to them in the middle of... I love how they do this. We don't know what happens here. It's just like a whirlwind storm. He'll ends up over here. So we'll get there in a minute. We boarded a ship from Adramidium about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia. We put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. Have we seen Aristarchus before? Where? Say it again. Chapter close to 19. Chapter. Oh, maybe I should put that on the test. That's a good one. Chapter 20, verse 4. After the riot of Ephesus, when the uproar had ended, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He traveled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people, and finally arrived in Greece, where he stayed 3 months. Because the Jews made a plot against him, just as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. He was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus, from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus, from Thessalonica, Gaius and Derbe, Timothy also, Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. What was this group of people doing? Why were they traveling with Paul? Where were they headed? Yes, they were taking the offering to Jerusalem. Aristarchus goes from Thessalonica with Paul to Jerusalem and has been with him, possibly even in Caesarea, for the couple of years they've been there after they've delivered the offering to the church in Jerusalem. That's Aristarchus. Aristarchus actually becomes pretty important throughout the rest of the New Testament. Philemon, verse 24, because there's only one chapter, verse 24, Paul says that Aristarchus is actually with him, and Paul is writing in captivity at that point. And you'll see in Colossians 4, verse 10, that Aristarchus is called by Paul a fellow prisoner. It is possible that Aristarchus, even at this point, is a prisoner as well. It's very possible. Why would he be a prisoner? Same reason why Paul is, preaching the gospel that the Jews are not happy with. Get as many as you can, round them up, cause problems. Verse 3, the next day we landed at Sidon. So they're down here in Caesarea. Let me zoom in. They're down here in Caesarea. The next day they go to Sidon. That would have been normal speed that this type of ship would have been going. Sidon, it's only 70 miles north. This is easily attainable in 24 hours, hence the phrase next day. What that indicates is this. At this point, no real issues on traveling. It's pretty simple. Just zip right up the coast. Now we're in Sidon. Good. Things are going great. Well, they are for now. The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in his kindness to Paul, allowed Paul to go to his friends so that they might provide for his needs. That is pretty rare. Why is that rare? What is strange about that? Paul's a prisoner. He's a prisoner. And they stop for a couple days. He's like, hey, go see your friends. It'll be great. But notice what happens. The next day we landed at Sidon, in verse 3, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so they might provide for his needs. What do you notice? The we is not going with him. It's just Paul. Matter of fact, the reason why Julius probably let him do this is at least twofold, although Luke adds a third one. Number one, because Paul probably, they looked at him and said, man, this guy is rich and honorable. Because even as a prisoner, he's got servants that travel with him that are dedicated and loyal to him. One of those servants even being a doctor. And we can use a doctor when we're traveling for quite a little bit on the open seas, because people will be getting sick. That's for sure. So we'll send Paul away, but we're going to keep his servants as collateral. Oh, you'll be back. You're not going to bail because we have your property. And you know what? If you leave, well, you won't leave. Number two, he may also be allowing Paul to go to hang out with his friends because he may be expecting, Julius may be expecting to be able to glean some of the gifts that his friends give to Paul for himself. He may say, yeah, go get gifts, get food, get the best you can. And when you come back, you're going to give me 60% of it. It's possible. However, all that Luke says is he did it just because he was a nice guy. That's all the reason we get. Everything else was pieced together through history. He allowed him to go to his friends so they may provide for his needs. From there, we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. This is something we need to define right now. What is a lee? A lee. Any guesses before we give you the answer? Before I give you the answer? I don't know who the we would be. Yes, the lee literally means protection or safeguard. The protection or safeguard. And at this time of year, you have what's called the Etesian winds. It's the winds that would be coming from the west or the northwest. So the winds would be coming in this direction, coming down this way. So if you're going from Sidon, and you're going to be going, and you get up to Seleucia, but you're eventually going to be trying to go up here, the lee of Cyprus would be on this side. Because when the winds are coming from the west-northwest, this side would protect them from the winds, pushing them in the direction they don't want to go. Is that making sense? So he says initially, we go to the lee of the Cyprus because the Etesian winds were coming, west-northwest. It was difficult to travel in the open seas because you can't go straight at them. Even staying along the coast, it was difficult. But that's why we stayed to the lee of the island of Cyprus. Now, the reason why that's important is because the way in which the lee will be utilized once we get over here to Crete and things of that nature. So we're on the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, notice where that what he's talking about there. That's this region right up here. That's this region right here. The open sea. Why? Because when you have winds coming from this direction in, and this is your lee, well, eventually, if you want to get to where you want to get, you're going to have to go into the wind. And that's why they wanted it up here, because whenever, if you're going to shipwreck, shipwreck next to the coast. Don't go down here and try to zip up there. Because if you do that and you get shipwrecked, who knows where you'll end up. So if you're going to get shipwrecked, you're going straight into a wind, it's going to be difficult. At least stay near the coast. Land is your friend whenever the winds get out of control. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra and Lycia, right there. There, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. Notice, they initially start off in Caesarea on an Adramidian ship, a ship that was going up here to this city, Adramidium. But that ultimately isn't their goal, their destination. Their destination is over here in Rome. So once they get over here to Myra, what they finds is a ship, an Alexandrian grain ship, that is going to Rome. Why? Because grain in the 3rd century BC, Alexandria, notice where Alexandria is, it's down here in Egypt. This is a very rich region for grain. Very rich. Grain was so important because grain was the base sustenance of life. As a matter of fact, in around the 2nd century BC, one of the things that the Roman Empire did, that the emperor did, is he said, I will provide, as the emperor, I am your father. I am the one that will provide for your daily bread. There may be a connection there, from Matthew chapter 6, but you have to take my Matthew class to get that full thing. He says, as a result, if you are in the city of Rome, you always will have bread. And each month he would give them a ration of bread that would provide for their daily food. So the demand for grain inside the city of Rome was huge because they literally were giving it away free to those that lived in Rome and that were Roman citizens. And the best place to get the grain, the most robust amount of grain, was in Alexandria. So you'd have grain ships from Alexandria that were contracted out to Rome. The Alexandrian ships, their normal course would be to go up to Myra, from Alexandria to Myra. Because even with a northwest wind, we'll talk about it in a minute, this type of ship could go, if a northwest wind is coming, they could go this direction and still not be deterred. They'd come up to Myra, then they would come over here to the Aegean. They would be protected by all these little islands in the Aegean. They would come over here, and then eventually they would have to make a run for it right here to get over to Sicilia. And then they'd go up to Puteoli, which is right there, and eventually get the grain up to Rome. Are you following me? So whenever they're over here and they find a grain ship in Myra, they're thinking, okay, this is going to the direct location we want to go to, and that is Rome. Yes?
How long would
this? A couple of weeks, about a month. Okay. Yeah. All sea travel takes a long time.
Right.
Matter of fact, well, we'll get to it in just a minute. Let me get there. This is the ship they would have been boarding in Myra, the Alexandrian ship. Notice how much bigger it is, how much it's even made to go in the open sea. The mast is huge in the middle. This is the mast. We'll talk about that in a bit. That'll actually become important. You have even just the way in which the stern and the bow are made. You even have this little sail up front because ultimately it is made for the open sea. Matter of fact, a ship like this, I know this looks silly, but a ship like this, if a wind is coming straight from the north, it could sail 7 points into the wind and still make progress. So it couldn't go directly into a wind that's coming from the north. But it could still get you north. It would just have to be going in this direction. Does that make sense? So if the winds are coming northwest, it could still go directly north. If the winds are coming from, let's say, west-northwest, which is what it is, it could still get you straight north. And that's why Alexandria, that's why going from Alexandria to Myra makes sense. It can still do that. But that's on the open sea. Whenever it's got the aid of the coastline, it can even go more directly into the wind. Does that make sense? So you've got to constantly be playing this, in a sense, a roulette with the wind. Are you going to get the favorable wind? Good, let's go for it. And let's get to where we can get. We'll stop there, and then we'll wait until we get a favorable wind, then we'll go again. And that's what you're doing. But this type of a ship was much more powerful and possible to get in the open sea than the one they were dealing with previously, this little dinky one. Okay? How long would it take you? A ship like this, in favorable conditions, with a gentle wind, could go about 8 to 9 miles per hour. So, I mean, with 8 to 9 miles per hour, you're talking, you can make some significant ground in a period of 24 hours, about 190 miles or so, 216 miles in 24 hours. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's keep moving. Oh, no, there's one more thing that's important about this as well. This type of grain ship is also important because it could carry around 10 to 11 tons of weight, which would be around 2 million to 2.2 million pounds. This is a big ship. And when you have a 100, you know, a centurion with all of his prisoners and soldiers and all the cargo, this is the type of ship they needed. This is the type of ship they find when they get into good old Myra. All right, where are we at? Verse 6. Now, we're going through a lot of details right now so we can set up the exact events that are happening in just a moment. Are you following me? So I know a lot of you are tempted to check out right now. Don't, because you'll be lost in a minute. Okay? Hang with me. We're getting somewhere. All right? There, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty moving off Cnidus. Even with this type of ship, going from Myra to Cnidus, it proved to be quite difficult. Why? Because when you have west-northwest winds coming and your coastline is slanting to the northwest, it means you're going almost directly into the wind. Now, if you're in the open sea, you couldn't handle this. With a coast, you can navigate. And that's what's happening. They're having a long time. Matter of fact, well, we'll get there in a minute. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salmone. What they would have done once they hit Cnidus is they would have tried to keep going up the Aegean to be protected by some of these islands. The problem is the wind was so strong coming from the west-northwest, they couldn't hold that course. They couldn't keep going west-northwest. Eventually, what they had to do is they had to go south. Makes sense. You're not going into the wind at all. You're actually using the wind to push you along quicker. Is that making sense? You come down to the Lee of Crete. What is the Lee of Crete? The Lee of Crete would have been the southern side of the island, which, let me zoom in down there. The southern side of the island, down here on the base. This is Lee. When you have a wind that's coming from the west-northwest, if you're on this side of Crete, you're totally protected from the wind. As a matter of fact, topographically, if you can see, it is even a mountainous island. It's an island that would have had a lot of protection because of the elevation that would have been in the mountainous regions there. So they go to the Lee of Crete. They go south. This actually is quite a little ways out of the way. This would have been over around 160 miles out of the way. Out of the way. But why are they doing that? Why would they go 140 to 160 miles out of their way? What? Because the wind dictates their course. There's only so much they can do, even with an Alexandrian grain ship. There's only so much they can do. So they go down to the Lee of Crete, opposite of Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lesia. Fair Havens is right here. You see Fair Havens right there? Man, I wish I could zoom in whenever. Sorry, hold on a second. There we go. Fair Havens is right in the middle. But notice what's happening to the Lee of Crete once you get to Fair Havens. Notice what happens. Can you piece that together? What would be a difficulty? Why would getting to Fair Havens be so tough? Yeah, because all of a sudden the entire island, the coastline that has been their protection, now it starts going west-northwest. As a result of that, the winds that are coming this direction, they would have a lot of difficulty even just getting up to here. Because the winds would they be going directly into them. Even with the coast, it would have proved quite difficult. But eventually they make it. With great difficulty, they come to Fair Havens near the town of Lycia. Much time had been lost, and sailing had become quite dangerous because by now it was after the fast. How much time was lost? At this point, it is possible that it has taken them 2 to 3 weeks just to get here. Just to get here from Myra. Oh, hello. Just to get to this location from Myra, it's possible it's taken them 2 to 3 weeks. So they've been out on sea at this point for almost 4 weeks. And they've only made it really halfway to their destination. And the hardest part is still yet to come. Why? Why is this the hardest part? Not because of the distance, because there's no protection. It's open sea. So they make it to Fair Havens. They're moving along the coast with quite difficulty. Much time had been lost and sailing had become quite dangerous because by now it was after the fast. What is the fast? The Day of Atonement. That's exactly right. The Day of Atonement was called the fast because there was a period during this festival of 24 hours of fasting and praying. 25 hours of fasting and praying. So you can refer to the Day of Atonement as just the fast. The Day of Atonement would have been on the 10th day of Tishri, or the 10th day of the 7th month of Jewish calendar. So we have two options of when this would have been. Number one, it could have been September 23rd, 60, AD 60. September 23rd, AD 60. Or it could have been October 5th, AD 59. I take the second option. And here's the reason why. He mentions that this is the dangerous time for sailing. The dangerous time period for sailing would have been September 14th through November 11th. Let me write this on the board. The dangerous time for sailing would have been September 14th through November 11th. The seasons are changing. The winds are becoming, it's going to become winter season. As a matter of fact, from November 11th to March, I think it's just March in general. I think they just kind of... No, it is. It's specific. March 10th. This is when the nautical lanes, whenever sea travel was shut down completely. You do not travel in these months. Wherever you're at, you stay there for those months. He says, we are already after the fast. If the two options for the fast would have been September 23rd for AD 60, or October, what did I say, 3rd? 5th? Of AD 59, his indication it's already after the fast, and based on some of the other indicators we have throughout the rest of the text, AD 59 is the most logical, which would mean that they are coming close to November already. It's a very dangerous time for them to be traveling. He says, matter of fact, the lanes are about to be closed. We don't have much time. We got to get there. So Paul warned them, verse 10, men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. Do you hear that? He says, I'm telling you right now, we're going to lose a lot on this ship and this cargo. And even, it looks like some of us are even going to die. Oh, yeah. And so his point was, we need to stop. We need to stay in Fair Havens. I know it's not ideal, but we need to stay. At this point, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Verse 11, but the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and the owner of the ship. As the centurion, the one that calls the shots, the one that's in control, you have three people that are telling you something. You have the owner of the ship. That's a guy that's probably been around the block more than once. He's the one that owns the ship. He's the one that's, you know, if Julius wasn't on board, he'd be the one calling the shots. The owner of the ship is saying, no, we need to go. Number two, you have the captain. The captain, who was hired by the owner of the ship because he is an expert of sea travel, says, no, we need to keep going. Then you have Paul, a tent maker, saying, hey, we need to stop. If you're just the centurion, based off conventional wisdom, who would you go with? Is that a hard question? Who would you go with? The captain. The owner of the ship. And there's a couple of things, though, he doesn't take into account. Number one, what do the captain and the owner have at stake here? A lot of money. They have a whole grain ship coming from Egypt. At the time of year, whenever the nautical lanes are about to be closed, that means they can charge a hefty price for their cargo because there's not going to be any coming for a couple months. They have a lot of money riding on getting there. The second thing he doesn't take into account is this isn't just some random tent maker. As a matter of fact, 2 Corinthians chapter 11 is pretty significant at this point. Chapter 11, verse 24 through 25, Paul's talking. He says, 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. Guess when 2 Corinthians was written? 57. When are we right now? 59. Paul has been shipwrecked 3 times, once in the open sea, even before this event. He's been around the block more than once. He says, guys, I've seen this before. I'm telling you, this is not a good idea. telling you, this is not a good day. We're heading right for disaster. Oh, we'll be fine. And Paul's going, it's happened to me 3 times already. Okay, we'll do it your way. 3 times. He's been shipwrecked. He's seen this before. It's happening again. But they decide to push on against Paul's advice. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the harbor in Fair Havens, why was the harbor unsuitable? They have 200 some odd men at least on board. At least. 267, if not more. They have at least that many. And Fair Havens is next to Lasea, and that city is not able to harbor that many people for this long of a time period. It just couldn't happen. And there probably also wasn't a lot of the entertainment that these men would have liked in Lasea as well. And therefore, they want to get to a place that would be much more metropolitan-like or debauchery-driven. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. Phoenix is actually, you won't be able to see it directly on this map, but I'll tell you the general location. It'd be at the edge over here of Crete. This is where they're ultimately wanting to head, over here. As a matter of fact, it has a port, possibly even right here at this tip, a port that would give them really good protection, as well as a city where they could have a lot of interaction with pretty much anything they were looking for. So they want to get to Phoenix. That's where they want to go. This was a harbor in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they'd obtained what they wanted. Why? Why were they looking for a south wind? Yeah, because where are they right now? They're in Fair Havens. And they're wanting to go north-northwest. That's where they're wanting to head. If a south wind starts to come, that's exactly what they needed to push them along to get to Phoenix. They'd be safe. They find what they look for, they push out to sea, and then trouble begins. They thought they had what they wanted, so they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. Matter of fact, the word that's used there for hurricane wind is typhoon wind, a swirling wind where competing wind currents come together and it causes a big mess, a very strong mess. As a matter of fact, it's called the Northeaster because it's a north wind and an east wind that combine together. And if you notice right here, this is all mountainous region. So they're trying to go this direction, northwest, and all of a sudden a northeast wind comes down off the mountains and slams into them. At that point, what are they in danger of doing? Not just getting off the coast, but capsizing. If you're going northwest and a northeast wind comes and slams you broadside, you could flip. That's a big problem. That's a big ship. That ship flips, it's over. So what do they do? Well, let's keep reading. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind. So we gave way to it and were driven along. They just said, we can't fight this wind. We just have to be driven by it. So they just turned the rudders of the ship and they just start sailing south. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, see it down there at the bottom? Oh, I can't zoom in. You guys see it though, down at the bottom? Down here? They're going up this direction, the northeastern hits them, they go south, and now they're getting down here to the lee, which would have been this little sliver of Cauda. Cauda is only 6 miles wide compared to Crete, which is 160 miles wide. They don't have much lee. They don't have much protection. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. If you're on one of these types of boats, the lifeboat would be kept at the back of the boat, at the edge. But that's a problem. Because if you're being pushed by a northeastern wind and your lifeboat's back there, what could be happening? Yes. The motion, say what your motion is. Pounding against it, or it could be taking on water itself. And if you have something in the back of your boat that's taking on water, what your whole boat, at that point, you can't control it, you can't steer it, and it could be pulling you under or back. It could be causing a lot of problems. But notice what it says in there. We were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. What they would have had to have done is to hoist the entire lifeboat full of water onto the boat. Or at least just let it go. But they didn't want to let it go because they may need that. So we, Luke, matter of fact, F.F. Bruce says, in the word we, whenever he uses the word hardly, and we tried to make it secure, he says you could almost hear Luke reflecting on the blisters that he had from pulling in that lifeboat. As he's raking it in, he says, man, we barely got in, but we got it in. Let's keep moving. As a matter of fact, actually, let me stop right there and say, there will be five things that they will do to try to save themselves from basically death. And the first thing is securing this lifeboat. That is the first thing they got to do. Get the lifeboat secure so that they can actually have a chance of making it through this. Because the Northeaster, well, that's a big problem. It's pushed them to the south. First thing they do is to try to make sure they get the lifeboat secure. Chapter 27, verse 17. When the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. That's the second thing they do. Second thing they do is they would take from one side of the ship to the other, they would hoist a cable underneath the boat, and then they would latch it to itself on the top. And the reason why is because of the problem of the big mast in the middle here. When the wind is whipping around, this mast, which goes all the way through the center of the boat, would be moving back and forth to where the timbers of the boat would actually start to separate. Excuse me. And what the cables would do is they would be latched around the side to try to hold the whole boat together because the mast was pulling it apart. So that's the second thing they had to do to make sure they might even have a chance of surviving what they were facing. Fearing that they would run aground on the sandbars of Sirtis, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. Second thing they did, third thing they did, was to develop an anchor. Now, the problem is this isn't the exact word for anchor that we would normally have. The normal word for an anchor is something totally different. More than likely, what they did was cut down this big mast and to throw it outside the back attached to a rope in the back so it'd be pulling them along, functioning as an anchor and something that couldn't be taking on water to hurt them, but something that would slow down their progress. Which also, without that big sail, you wouldn't have to worry about being pushed around too much because you have nothing to push you around because you've pulled your sails away. And why are they afraid of the sandbars of Sirtis? The sandbars of Sirtis are actually located down here near Cyrene. It's in this region here. And the reason why that's so bad is the sandbars were constantly being pushed around by the ocean. So if you're trying to navigate your way through the water, especially you don't want to get too shallow so your boat gets stuck and you get shipwrecked in the middle of the crashing water and stuff like that, a sandbar is a big problem, especially the ones of Sirtis, because they shifted, they moved. You couldn't tell where the sandbars not only were, but you couldn't tell where they were going to be in moments later. Sandbars of Sirtis, as a matter of fact, were notorious for shipwrecks. It was kind of like one of the things, you get these nautical lore, these legends that you're afraid of. Oh, be afraid of the huge octopus. You've got to be afraid of the huge squid. You've heard those stories? Be afraid of the sandbars of Sirtis. It's people that get caught in there and never get out. And they know that's to the south of Crete. And they know that's exactly the direction they're being pushed. And they're doing whatever they can not to get hit in the sandbars of Sirtis. So, first three things they do. Number one, secure the lifeboat. Number two, they do frapping, which that's what that's called whenever you put the cable underneath the boat and secure it on the other side. Number three, they cut down the mast and use it as an anchor. Verse 18. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. Number four. They're saying, hey, we got to do something. We're going to go down if we don't, we're still taking on water. I mean, we've got the mast down, we've got the lifeboat in, and we're still taking on water. Something's got to happen. So what do you got to do? Get rid of the weight. And the big weight is the cargo. They start dumping the grain overboard. But they don't dump all of it overboard, because we'll see in several verses that they still have some cargo eventually. But they're literally willing to throw money overboard because they're afraid of where they're headed. So they start throwing the cargo overboard as the fourth way of trying to save themselves from the storm. On the third day of being violently battered by this wind, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. That is a desperate move. The tackle is the stuff that maybe you could use to reconstruct your mast. The tackle would have included the very sails that middle mast would have held. It was the last ditch effort. Because at this point what you're saying is, I hope we just get stranded on an island somewhere. We're not going to make it to Rome probably. Not like this. But at least maybe we can salvage some of the cargo, salvage our own lives. But navigating through this isn't much of an option. So they start throwing the tackle overboard. And that's the fifth thing they do. Throw the tackle overboard. Just survival mode. That's where they're at. Survival mode. Verse 20. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days. Oh. Why is that a problem? Yeah. Man, if you are someone that knows the sea, you understand that your only direction, the only way you know where you're at or where you're headed, is whenever you have the stars and the sun, whenever they're able to give you some sort of direction. And when it's been over 3 days and you haven't seen any of them, at this point, you don't know where you're at. At this point, you may already be all the way over here, or you may be back here. You don't know where you're at. And when you don't know where you're at, trying to find a safe direction to go, it's pretty difficult. Desperation, you got to hear it in their voices here. We're at a loss. We've done everything we can. We don't even know where we're at. There appeared, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, possibly around 11 days at this point. And the storm continued raging. We finally gave up all hope of being saved. This is it. We're done. After the men had gone a long time without food, why would they have gone a long time without food? What's that? Yeah, number one, they've thrown some of their grain overboard. Number two, during 11 days of fighting a storm, it doesn't leave you very much time to say, time out, it's time for lunch. You don't. Number three, when you're being battered around all over, more than likely a lot of them are dealing with seasickness as well. Food has been something that's not been a top priority because they've been just trying to survive. After a long time of going without food, Paul stood up before the men and said, I love this. Men, you should have taken my advice. Basically, it's an I told you so. I told you back when we were in Fair Havens. Shouldn't have done this. But, you know, you greedy bunch of punks had to get all the way over to Rome. Should have listened to the tent maker, fools. Not to sail to Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. In other words, you only have yourself to blame. But then verse 22. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Hold on. What? That's weird, is it not? Why is that strange? Earlier, in verse 10, he says, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to our ship and cargo, and to our own lives also. Now he's saying, actually, none of you are going to die. Is he a flip-flopper, just like all other politicians? What's happening here? Yes, that's the difference. In verse 10, he's saying, I've been here before. This is not a good idea. Trust me. I've been sailing before. This is not looking good. His personal experience is informing the information. Here, though, we're going to see in a minute, he's had an actual vision, to where he can definitively say what is going to happen. Even though what we will find later is that even the vision is conditional as long as they do what Paul says. That should maybe rebuke some of our sense of what prophecy is, because prophecies are always conditional. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. And they're like, what? We're going to lose the ship? Yep, sorry. Last night, an angel of the Lord, whose I am, and whom I serve, notice identity language there, stood beside me and said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all those who sail with you. That right there gives us a little bit of an insight into Paul's prayer closet. What was Paul praying for? Yeah, he was praying. Number one, you can hear Paul saying, hey, I thought I was going to make it to Rome. I really want to preach before Caesar, and this isn't looking good. And I've been here before, and you know, my life's been spared before, but this is looking really bad. And for 11 days, possibly 12, Paul's been praying to God, and God has not answered him until the last night. And Paul, you hear that, number one, Paul is praying that he makes it to Rome. Number two, he's also praying that the other people will be spared. Paul's saying, listen, I know I'm safe, I guess. I'm feeling a little bit discomfort in that, but I'm going to trust you, but I don't know if they're safe. Are they safe? And God says, yeah, I've granted all of your wishes. You will make it, and everyone will be safe because of you. And now here's the point in that. So stop your talking, stop your giggling, stop your sleeping, and listen. There'll be times in your life whenever you'll be in the middle of a storm that's as strong as a northeaster. And you will beseech God and you'll beg God and you'll fast for God and you'll pray to God and you will beg Him just to give you a word. And you'll go for 11, 12, 13 days and not hear anything. And in a time like that, it feels like an eternity. Because literally, you don't know if you're going to make it out of this moment. You just don't know. But never, never for once think that He isn't listening and that He will not eventually speak to you. He will be there with you. We were talking about it this morning in Mark chapter 15. When Jesus is on the cross and He cries out, my God, why have You forsaken Me? I do not believe in that moment. I do not believe in that moment that God abandoned Jesus. And the reason why I don't is because of Psalm 22. That's the psalm he's singing. Psalm 22 that David sang. And it starts off, my God, why have You forsaken Me? I cry out for You and yet You don't answer. A day and night I cry out for You and You don't answer. And then verse 3 of Psalm 22 says, And yet You are a God I trust. Because my fathers trusted You and You delivered. My father's father trusted You and You delivered. Everyone I have known that means anything to me has trusted You and You delivered. Therefore, I know even in this moment, You will deliver me. You will be feeling like you're in a northeaster at some point, and maybe even feel like it right now. And I'm telling you, even whenever you feel like your prayers are bouncing off the ceiling back down at you, they're not. It's so tempting to believe just because your eyes can't see what it is you're talking to that it's not there. But He's always listening. And He's always moving. And it may not be in the ways in which you demand Him to move, but just because He's not following your cues doesn't mean He's not moving. Even if it takes 11 days, you stand faithful and you trust He will answer. And it may not be an answer you're looking for, it may not even be the answer you expected, but He will answer. Love you guys. See you in the morning.